I letters, and a certain splendour belonging to them that distinguishes them above all. And bear in mind what I am now about to say to you, for it will be of great use and comfort to you in time of trouble. It is not to let your mind dwell on the adverse chances that may befall you. For the worst of all is death, and if it be a good death, the best of all is to die. They asked Julius Caesar, the valiant Roman emperor, what was the best death. He answered, that which is unexpected, which comes suddenly and unforeseen. And though he answered like a pagan, and one without the knowledge of the true God, yet as far as sparing our feelings is concerned, he was right. For suppose you are killed in the first engagement or skirmish, whether by a cannonball or blown up by a mine, what matters it? It is only dying, and all is over. And according to Terence, a soldier shows better dead in battle than alive and safe in flight. And the good soldier wins fame in proportion as he is obedient to his captains and those in command over him. And remember, my son, that it is better for the soldier to smell of gunpowder than of civet, and that if old age should come upon you in this honourable calling, though you may be covered with wounds and crippled and lame, it will not come upon you without honour, and that such as poverty cannot lessen, especially now that provisions are being made for supporting and relieving old and disabled soldiers. For it is not right to deal with them after the fashion of those who set free and get rid of their black slaves when they are old and useless, and turning them out of their houses under the pretense of making them free, make them slaves to hunger, from which they cannot expect to be released except by death. But for the present, I won't say more than get ye up behind me on my horse as far as the inn, and sup with me there, and tomorrow you shall pursue your journey, and God give you as good speed as your intentions deserve. The page did not accept the invitation to mount, though he did that to supper at the inn. And here they say Sancho said to himself, God be with you for a master. Is it possible that a man who can say things so many and so good as he has said just now, can say that he saw the impossible absurdities he reports about the cave of Montesinos? Well, well, we shall see. And now, just as night was falling, they reached the inn. And it was not without satisfaction that Sancho perceived his master took it for a real inn, and not for a castle, as usual. The instant they entered, Don Quixote asked the landlord after the man with the lances and halberds, and was told that he was in the stable seeing to his mule, which was what Sancho and the cousin proceeded to do for their beasts, giving the best manger and the best place in the stable to Rocinante. Chapter 25. Wherein is set down the braying adventure, and the droll one of the puppet showman, together with the memorable divinations of the divining ape. Don Quixote's bread would not bake, as the common saying is, until he had heard and learned the curious things promised by the man who carried the arms. He went to seek him where the innkeeper said he was, and having found him, bade him say now, at any rate, what he had to say in answer to the question he had asked him on the road.
"The tale of my wonders must be taken more leisurely and not standing," said the man. "Let me finish foddering my beast, good sir, and then I'll tell you things that will astonish you." "Don't wait for that," said Don Quixote. "I'll help you in everything." And so he did, sifting the barley for him and cleaning out the manger, a degree of humility which made the other feel bound to tell him with a good grace what he had asked. So seating himself on a bench, with Don Quixote beside him, and the cousin, the page, Sancho Panza, and the landlord for a senate and an audience, he began his story in this way. "You must know that in a village 4 leagues and a half from this inn, it so happened that one of the councillors, by the tricks and roguery of a servant girl of his—it's too long a tale to tell—lost an ass, and though he did all he possibly could to find it, it was all to no purpose. A fortnight might have gone by, so the story goes, since the ass had been missing, when, as the councillor who had lost it was standing in the plaza, another councillor of the same town said to him, 'Pay me for good news, friend, your ass has turned up.' 'That I will, and well, friend,' said the other, 'but tell us, where has he turned up?' 'In the forest,' said the finder. 'I saw him this morning without pack-saddle or harness of any sort, and so lean that it went to one's heart to see him. I tried to drive him before me and bring him to you, but he is already so wild and shy that when I went near him he made off into the thickest part of the forest. If you have a mind that we two should go back and look for him, let me put up this she-ass at my house, and I'll be back at once.' "'You will be doing me a great kindness,' said the owner of the ass, 'and I'll try to pay it back in the same coin.'
It is, with all these circumstances, and in the very same way I am telling it now, that those who know all about the matter tell the story. Well, then, the two counsellors set off on foot, arm in arm, for the forest, and coming to the place where they hoped to find the ass, they could not find him, nor was he to be seen anywhere about, search as they might. Seeing, then, that there was no sign of him, the counsellor, who had seen him, said to the other, "Look here, friend, a plan has occurred to me, by which, beyond a doubt, we shall manage to discover the animal, even if he is stowed away in the bowels of the earth, not to say the forest. Here it is. I can bray to perfection, and if you can ever so little, the thing's as good as done." "Ever so little, did you say, friend?" said the other. "By God, I'll not give in to anybody, not even to the asses themselves." "We'll soon see," said the second counsellor, "for my plan is that you should go one side of the forest, and I the other, so as to go all round about it. And every now and then you will bray, and I will bray, and it cannot be but that the ass will hear us and answer us if he is in the forest." To which the owner of the ass replied, "It's an excellent plan, I declare, friend, and worthy of your great genius." And the two, separating as agreed, it so fell out that they brayed almost at the same moment, and each, deceived by the braying of the other, ran to look, fancying the ass had turned up at last. When they came in sight of one another, said the loser, "Is it possible, friend, that it was not my ass that brayed?" "No, it was I," said the other. "Well, then, I can tell you, friend," said the ass's owner, "that between you and an ass there is not an atom of difference, as far as braying goes, for I never in all my life saw or heard anything more natural." "Those praises and compliments belong to you more justly than to me, friend," said the inventor of the plan, "for by the God that made me you might give me a couple of brays odds to the best and most finished brayer in the world. The tone you have got is deep, your voice is well kept up as to time and pitch, and your finishing notes come thick and fast. In fact, I own myself beaten and yield the palm to you and give in to you in this rare accomplishment." "Well, then," said the owner, "I'll set a higher value on myself for the future, and consider that I know something, as I have an excellence of some sort. For though I always thought I brayed well, I never supposed I came up to the pitch of perfection you say." "And I say, too," said the second, "that there are rare gifts going to loss in the world, and that they are ill bestowed upon those who don't know how to make use of them." "Ours," said the owner of the ass, "unless it is in cases like this we have now in hand, cannot be of any service to us, and even in this, God grant they may be of some use." So saying, they separated, and took to their braying once more. But every instant they were deceiving one another, and coming to meet one another again, until they arranged, by way of countersign, so as to know that it was they and not the ass, to give two brays, one after the other. In this way, doubling the brays at every step, they made the complete circuit of the forest, but the lost ass never gave them an answer, or even the sign of one. How could the poor ill-starred brute have answered when, in the thickest part of the forest, they found him devoured by wolves? As soon as he saw him, his owner said, "I was wondering he did not answer, for if he wasn't dead he'd have brayed when he heard us, or he'd have been no ass. But for the sake of having heard you bray to such perfection, my friend, I count the trouble I have taken to look for him well bestowed, even though I have found him dead." "It's in a good hand, friend," said the other. "If the abbot sings well, the acolyte is not much behind him." So they returned, disconsolate and hoarse, to their village, where they told their friends, neighbours, and acquaintances what had befallen them in their search for the ass, each crying up the other's perfection in braying. The whole story came to be known and spread abroad through the villages of the neighbourhood, and the devil, who never sleeps with his love for sowing dissensions and scattering discord everywhere, blowing mischief about and making quarrels out of nothing, contrived to make the people of the other towns fall to braying whenever they saw anyone from our village, as if to throw the braying of our counsellors in our teeth. Then the boys took to it, which was the same thing for it as getting into the hands and mouths of all the devils of hell, and braying spread from one town to another in such a way that the men of the braying town are as easy to be known as blacks are to be known from whites, and the unlucky joke has gone so far that several times the scoffed have come out in arms and in a body to do battle with the scoffers, and neither king nor rook, fear nor shame, can mend matters. Tomorrow, or the day after, I believe, the men of my town, that is, of the braying town, are going to take the field against another village 2 leagues away from ours, one of those that persecute us most.
and that we may turn out well prepared, I have brought these lances and halberds you have seen. These are the curious things I told you I had to tell, and if you don't think them so, I have no others."
And with this the worthy fellow brought his story to a close. Just at this moment there came in at the gate of the inn a man entirely clad in chamois leather, hose, breeches, and doublet, who said in a loud voice,
"Senor host, have you room? Here's the divining ape and the puppet show of the release of Melisendra just coming."
"Odd's body," said the landlord. "Why, it's Master Pedro. We're in for a grand night."
I forgot to mention that the said Master Pedro had his left eye and nearly half his cheek covered with a patch of green taffeta, showing that something ailed all that side.
"Your worship is welcome, Master Pedro," continued the landlord. "But where are the ape and the show, for I don't see them?"
"They are close at hand," said he, in the chamois leather. "But I came on first to know if there was any room."
"I'd make the Duke of Alva himself clear out to make room for Master Pedro," said the landlord. "Bring in the ape and the show. There's company in the inn tonight that will pay to see that and the cleverness of the ape."
"So be it by all means," said the man with the patch. "I'll lower the price, and be well satisfied if I only pay my expenses. And now I'll go back and hurry on the cart with the ape and the show."
And with this he went out of the inn. Don Quixote at once asked the landlord what this Master Pedro was, and what was the show, and what was the ape he had with him. To which the landlord replied,
"This is a famous puppet showman, who for some time past has been going about this Mancha de Aragon, exhibiting a show of the release of Melisendra by the famous Don Guy Ferros, one of the best and best represented stories that have been seen in this part of the kingdom for many a year. He has also with him an ape, with the most extraordinary gift ever seen in an ape or imagined in a human being. For if you ask him anything, he listens attentively to the question, and then jumps on his master's shoulder, and pressing close to his ear, tells him the answer, which Master Pedro then delivers. He says a great deal more about things past than about things to come, and though he does not always hit the truth in every case, most times he's not far wrong, so that he makes us fancy he has got the devil in him. He gets 2 reals for every question if the ape answers. I mean, if his master answers for him after he has whispered into his ear. And so it is believed that this same Master Pedro is very rich. He is a gallant man, as they say in Italy, and good company, and leads the finest life in the world, talks more than 6, drinks more than 12, and all by his tongue and his ape and his show."
Master Pedro now came back, and in a cart followed the show and the ape, a big one, without a tail, and with buttocks as bare as felt, but not vicious-looking. As soon as Don Quixote saw him, he asked him,
"Can you tell me, Sir Fortune-teller, what fish do we catch, and how will it be with us? See, here are my 2 reals," and he bade Sancho give them to Master Pedro.
But he answered for the ape, and said,
"Señor, this animal does not give any answer or information touching things that are to come. Of things past he knows something, and more or less of things present."
"Gad," said Sancho, "I would not give a farthing to be told what's past with me, for who knows that better than I do myself? And to pay for being told what I know would be mighty foolish. But as you know things present, here are my 2 reals, and tell me, most excellent Sir Ape, what is my wife Teresa Panza doing now, and what is she diverting herself with?"
Master Pedro refused to take the money, saying,
"I will not receive payment in advance, or until the service has been first rendered."
And then with his right hand he gave a couple of slaps on his left shoulder, and with one spring the ape perched himself upon it, and putting his mouth to his master's ear began chattering his teeth rapidly. And having kept this up as long as one would be saying a credo, with another spring he brought himself to the ground, and the same instant Master Pedro ran in great haste and fell upon his knees before Don Quixote, and embracing his legs exclaimed,
"These legs do I embrace as I would embrace the 2 pillars of Hercules. Oh, illustrious reviver of knight-errantry, so long consigned to oblivion! Oh, never yet duly extolled knight Don Quixote of La Mancha! Courage of the faint-hearted, prop of the tottering arm of the fallen staff and counsel of all who are unfortunate!"
Don Quixote was thunderstruck, Sancho astounded, the cousins staggered, the page astonished, the man from the braying town agape, the landlord in perplexity, and in short, everyone amazed, at the words of the puppet showman, who went on to say,
"And thou, worthy Sancho Panza, the best squire and squire to the best knight in the world, be of good cheer, for thy good wife Teresa is well, and she is at this moment hackling a pound of flax. And more by token,
She has at her left hand a jug with a broken spout that holds a good drop of wine, with which she solaces herself at her work.
"That I can well believe," said Sancho. "She is a lucky one, and if it was not for her jealousy, I would not change her for the giantess Andandona, who, by my master's account, was a very clever and worthy woman. My Teresa is one of those that won't let themselves want for anything, though their heirs may have to pay for it."
"Now I declare," said Don Quixote, "he who reads much and travels much sees and knows a great deal. I say so because what amount of persuasion could have persuaded me that there are apes in the world that can divine as I have seen now with my own eyes? For I am that very Don Quixote of La Mancha this worthy animal refers to, though he has gone rather too far in my praise. But whatever I may be, I thank heaven that it has endowed me with a tender and compassionate heart, always disposed to do good to all and harm to none."
"If I had the money," said the page, "I would ask Señor Ape what will happen to me in the peregrination I am making."
To this, Master Pedro, who had by this time risen from Don Quixote's feet, replied, "I have already said that this little beast gives no answer as to the future. But if he did, not having money would be of no consequence, for to oblige Señor Don Quixote here present I would give up all the profits in the world. And now, because I have promised it, and to afford him pleasure, I will set up my show and offer entertainments to all who are in the inn, without any charge whatever."
As soon as he heard this, the landlord, delighted beyond measure, pointed out a place where the show might be fixed, which was done at once. Don Quixote was not very well satisfied with the divinations of the ape, as he did not think it proper that an ape should divine anything, either past or future. So while Master Pedro was arranging the show, he retired with Sancho into a corner of the stable where, without being overheard by anyone, he said to him,
"Look here, Sancho, I have been seriously thinking over this ape's extraordinary gift, and I have come to the conclusion that beyond doubt this Master Pedro, his master, has a pact, tacit or express, with the devil."
"If this packet is expressed from the devil," said Sancho, "it must be a very dirty packet, no doubt. But what good can it do Master Pedro to have such packets?"
"Thou dost not understand me, Sancho," said Don Quixote. "I only mean he must have made some compact with the devil to infuse this power into the ape, that he may get his living, and after he has grown rich he will give him his soul, which is what the enemy of mankind wants. This I am led to believe by observing that the ape only answers about things past or present, and the devil's knowledge extends no further. For the future he knows only by guesswork, and that not always. For it is reserved for God alone to know the times and the seasons, and for him there is neither past nor future. All is present. This being as it is clear that this ape speaks by the spirit of the devil, and I am astonished they have not denounced him to the holy office of the Inquisition, and put him to the question and forced it out of him by whose virtue it is that he divines, because it is certain this ape is not an astrologer. Neither his master nor he sets up, or knows how to set up, those figures they call astrological tables, which are now so common in Spain that there is not a jade or page or old cobbler that will not undertake to cast up a table as readily as pick up a knave of cards from the ground, bringing to naught the marvellous truth of the science by their lies and ignorance. I know of a lady who asked one of these table-casting schemers whether her little lapdog would be in pup and would breed, and how many and of what colour the little pups would be. To which Señor Astrologer, after having cast his table, made answer that the bitch would be in pup and would drop 3 pups, one green, another bright red, and the third party-coloured, provided she conceived between 11 and 12 either of the day or night, and on a Monday or Saturday. But as things turned out, 2 days after this the bitch died of a surfeit, and Señor Planet Ruler had the credit all over the place of being a most profound astrologer, as most of these planet rulers have."
"Still," said Sancho, "I would be glad if your worship would make Master Pedro ask his ape whether what happened to your worship in the cave of Montesinos is true. For, begging your worship's pardon, I, for my part, take it to have been all flam and lies, or, at any rate, something you dreamt."
"That may be," replied Don Quixote. "However, I will do what you suggest, though I have my own scruples about it."
At this point Master Pedro came up in quest of Don Quixote, to tell him the show was now ready and to come and see it, for it was worth seeing. Don Quixote explained his wish, and begged him to ask his ape at once to tell him whether certain things which had happened to him in the cave of Montesinos were dreams or realities, for to him they appeared to partake of both.
Upon this, Master Pedro, without answering, went back to fetch the ape, and having placed it in front of Don Quixote and Sancho, said,
"See here, Señor Ape, this gentleman wishes to know whether certain things which happened to him in the cave called the Cave of Montesinos were false or true."
On his making the usual sign, the ape mounted on his left shoulder and seemed to whisper in his ear, and Master Pedro said at once,
"The ape says that the things you saw or that happened to you in that cave are, part of them, false, part true, and that he only knows this and no more as regards this question. But if your worship wishes to know more on Friday next, he will answer all that may be asked him, for his virtue is at present exhausted, and will not return to him till Friday, as he has said."
"Did I not say, Señor," said Sancho, "that I could not bring myself to believe that all your worship said about the adventures in the cave was true, or even the half of it?"
"The course of events will tell, Sancho," replied Don Quixote. "Time that discloses all things leaves nothing that it does not drag into the light of day, though it be buried in the bosom of the earth. But enough of that for the present. Let us go and see Master Pedro's show, for I am sure there must be something novel in it."
"Something," said Master Pedro. "This show of mine has 60,000 novel things in it, and let me tell you, Señor Don Quixote, it is one of the best worth seeing things in the world this day. But operibus credite et non verbis. Now let's get to work, for it is growing late, and we have a great deal to do and to say and show."
Don Quixote and Sancho obeyed him and went to where the show was already put up and uncovered, set all around with lighted wax tapers which made it look splendid and bright. When they came to it, Master Pedro ensconced himself inside it, for it was he who had to work the puppets, and a boy, a servant of his, posted himself outside to act as showman and explain the mysteries of the exhibition, having a wand in his hand to point to the figures as they came out. And so, all who were in the inn being arranged in front of the show, some of them standing, and Don Quixote, Sancho, the page, and cousin, accommodated with the best places, the interpreter began to say what he will hear or see who reads or hears the next chapter. Chapter 26. Wherein is continued the droll adventure of the puppet showman, together with other things in truth right good. All were silent, Tyrians and Trojans. I mean, all who were watching the show were hanging on the lips of the interpreter of its wonders, when drums and trumpets were heard to sound inside it and cannon to go off. The noise was soon over, and then the boy lifted up his voice and said,
"This true story, which is here represented to your worships, is taken word for word from the French chronicles and from the Spanish ballads that are in everybody's mouth, and in the mouth of the boys about the streets. Its subject is the release by Señor Don Gaiferos of his wife Melisendra, when a captive in Spain at the hands of the Moors, in the city of Sansuena, for so they called then what is now called Saragossa. And there you may see how Don Gaiferos is playing at the tables, just as they sing it, 'At tables playing Don Gaiferos sits, for Melisendra is forgotten now.' And that person who appears there with a crown on his head and a scepter in his hand is the Emperor Charlemagne, the supposed father of Melisendra, who, angered to see his son-in-law's inaction and unconcern, comes in to chide him, and observe with what vehemence and energy he chides him, so that you would fancy he was going to give him half a dozen raps with his scepter. And indeed, there are authors who say he did give them, and sound ones, too, and after having said a great deal to him about imperilling his honour by not effecting the release of his wife, he said, so the tale runs, 'Enough I've said, see to it now.' Observe, too, how the Emperor turns away and leaves Don Gaiferos fuming, and you see how in a burst of anger he flings the table and the board far from him, and calls in haste for his armour, and asks his cousin Don Roland for the loan of his sword, Durindana, and how Don Roland refuses to lend it, offering him his company in the difficult enterprise he is undertaking. But he, in his valour and anger, will not accept it, and says that he alone will suffice to rescue his wife, even though she were imprisoned deep in the centre of the earth. And with this he retires to arm himself and set out on his journey at once. Now, let your worships turn your eyes to that tower that appears there, which is supposed to be one of the towers of the Alcazar of Saragossa, now called the Aljaferia. That lady who appears on that balcony dressed in Moorish fashion is the peerless Melisendra, for many a time she used to gaze from thence upon the road to France, and seek consolation in her captivity by thinking of Paris and her husband. Observe, too, a new incident which now occurs, such as, perhaps, was never seen. Do you not see that Moor, who silently and stealthily with his finger on his lips, approaches Melisendra from behind? Observe now how he prints a kiss upon her lips, and what a hurry she is in to spit and wipe them with the white sleeve of her smock, and how she bewails herself and tears her fair hair as though it were to blame for the wrong. Observe, too, that the stately Moor who is in that corridor is King Marsilio of Sansuena, who, having seen the Moor's insolence, at once orders him, though his kinsman and a great favourite of his, to be seized and given 200 lashes while carried through the streets of the city according to custom, with criers going before him and officers of justice behind. And here you see them come out to execute the sentence, although the offence has been scarcely committed. For among the Moors there are no indictments nor remands as with us. Here Don Quixote called out, "Child, child! Go straight on with your story, and don't run into curves and slants, for to establish a fact clearly there is no need of a great deal of proof and confirmation." And said Master Pedro from within,
"Boy, stick to your text and do as the gentleman bids you. It's the best plan. Keep to your plain song and don't attempt harmonies, for they are apt to break down from being over fine."
"I will," said the boy. And he went on to say, "This figure that you see here on horseback, covered with a Gascon cloak, is Don Guy Feroz himself, whom his wife, now avenged of the insult of the amorous Moor, and taking her stand on the balcony of the tower with a calmer and more tranquil countenance, has perceived without recognizing him. And she addresses her husband, supposing him to be some traveller, and holds with him all that conversation and colloquy in the ballad that runs, 'If you, Sir Knight, to France are bound, O for Guy Feroz ask,' which I do not repeat here, because prolixity begets disgust. Suffice it to observe how Don Guy Feroz discovers himself, and that by her joyful gestures Melisendra shows us she has recognized him, and, what is more, we now see she lowers herself from the balcony to place herself on the haunches of her good husband's horse. But, ah, unhappy lady, the edge of her petticoat has caught on one of the bars of the balcony, and she is left hanging in the air, unable to reach the ground. But you see how compassionate heaven sends aid in our sorest need. Don Guy Feroz advances, and without minding whether the rich petticoat is torn or not, he seizes her, and by force brings her to the ground, and then, with one jerk, places her on the haunches of his horse, astraddle like a man, and bids her hold on tight and clasp her arms around his neck, crossing them on his breast so as not to fall, for the Lady Melisendra was not used to that style of riding. You see, too, how the neighing of the horse shows his satisfaction with the gallant and beautiful burden he bears in his lord and lady. You see how they wheel round and quit the city, and in joy and gladness take the road to Paris. Go in peace, O peerless pair of true lovers. May you reach your longed-for fatherland in safety, and may fortune interpose no impediment to your prosperous journey. May the eyes of your friends and kinsmen behold you enjoying in peace and tranquillity the remaining days of your life, and that they may be as many as those of Nestor." Here Master Pedro called out again and said,
"Simplicity, boy! None of your high flights! All affectation is bad!"
The interpreter made no answer, but went on to say, "There was no want of idle eyes that see everything to see Melisendra come down and mount, and word was brought to King Marsilio, who at once gave orders to sound the alarm, and see what a stir there is, and how the city is drowned with the sound of the bells pealing in the towers of all the mosques."
"Nay, nay," said Don Quixote at this. "On that point of the bells, Master Pedro is very inaccurate, for bells are not in use among the Moors. Only kettle-drums and a kind of small trumpet somewhat like our clarion. To ring bells this way in Sansuena is unquestionably a great absurdity."
On hearing this, Master Pedro stopped ringing and said,
"Don't look into trifles, Señor Don Quixote, or want to have things up to a pitch of perfection that is out of reach. Are there not almost every day 1,000 comedies represented all around us, full of thousands of inaccuracies and absurdities, and for all that they have a successful run, and are listened to not only with applause but with admiration and all the rest of it? Go on, boy, and don't mind. For so long as I fill my pouch, no matter if I show as many inaccuracies as there are motes in a sunbeam."
"True enough," said Don Quixote. And the boy went on, "See what a numerous and glittering crowd of horsemen issues from the city in pursuit of the two faithful lovers.
What a blowing of trumpets there is! What sounding of horns! What beating of drums and tabors! I fear me they will overtake them, and bring them back tied to the tail of their own horse, which would be a dreadful sight. Don Quixote, however, seeing such a swarm of Moors, and hearing the din, thought it would be right to aid the fugitives, and standing up he exclaimed in a loud voice,
"Never! While I live will I permit foul play to be practised in my presence on such a famous knight and fearless lover as Don Gaiferos. Halt, ill-born rabble, follow him not, nor pursue him, or ye will have to reckon with me in battle."
And suiting the action to the word, he drew his sword, and with one bound placed himself close to the show, and with unexampled rapidity and fury began to shower down blows on the puppet troop of Moors, knocking over some, decapitating others, maiming this one and demolishing that. And among many more he delivered one downstroke which, if Master Pedro had not ducked, made himself small and got out of the way, would have sliced off his head as easily as if it had been made of almond paste. Master Pedro kept shouting,
"Hold hard, Señor Don Quixote! Can't you see they're not real Moors you're knocking down and killing and destroying, but only little pasteboard figures? Look, sinner that I am, how you're wrecking and ruining all that I'm worth!"
But in spite of this, Don Quixote did not leave off discharging a continuous rain of cuts, slashes, downstrokes, and backstrokes, and at length, in less than the space of two credos, he brought the whole show to the ground, with all its fittings and figures shivered and knocked to pieces, King Marsilio badly wounded, and the Emperor Charlemagne with his crown and head split in two. The whole audience was thrown into confusion, the ape fled to the roof of the inn, the cousin was frightened, and even Sancho Panza himself was in mighty fear, for, as he swore after the storm was over, he had never seen his master in such a furious passion. The complete destruction of the show being thus accomplished, Don Quixote became a little calmer and said,
"I wish I had here before me now all those who do not or will not believe how useful knights errant are in the world. Just think, if I had not been here present, what would have become of the brave Don Gaiferos and the fair Melisendra? Depend upon it, by this time those dogs would have overtaken them and inflicted some outrage upon them. So then, long live knight-errantry beyond everything living on earth this day."
"Let it live and welcome," said Master Pedro at this in a feeble voice, "and let me die, for I am so unfortunate that I can say with King Don Rodrigo, 'Yesterday was I a lord of Spain. Today I've not a turret left that I may call mine own. Not half an hour, nay, barely a minute ago, I saw myself lord of kings and emperors, with my stables filled with countless horses, and my trunks and bags with gay dresses unnumbered. And now I find myself ruined and laid low, destitute and a beggar, and above all without my ape, for by my faith my teeth will have to sweat for it before I have him caught. And all through the reckless fury of a sir knight here, who, they say, protects the fatherless and rights wrongs and does other charitable deeds, but whose generous intentions have been found wanting in my case only, blessed and praised be the highest heavens. Verily, knight of the rueful figure he must be to have disfigured mine.'
Sancho Panza was touched by Master Pedro's words, and said to him, 'Don't weep and lament, Master Pedro. You break my heart. Let me tell you that my master Don Quixote is so Catholic and scrupulous a Christian that, if he can make out that he has done you any wrong, he will own it, and be willing to pay for it, and make it good, and something over and above.'
Only let Señor Don Quixote pay me for some part of the work he has destroyed, said Master Pedro, and I would be content, and his worship would ease his conscience, for he cannot be saved who keeps what is another's against the owner's will, and makes no restitution.
That is true, said Don Quixote, but at present I am not aware that I have got anything of yours, Master Pedro.
What? Returned Master Pedro. And these relics lying here on the bare hard ground? What scattered and shattered them but the invincible strength of that mighty arm? And whose were the bodies they belonged to but mine, and what did I get my living by but by them?
Now I am fully convinced, said Don Quixote, of what I had many a time before believed, that the enchanters who persecute me do nothing more than put figures like these before my eyes, and then change and turn them into what they please. In truth and earnest, I assure you, gentlemen who now hear me, that to me everything that has taken place here seemed to take place literally. That Melisendra was Melisendra, Don Gaiferos, Don Gaiferos, Marsilio, Marsilio, and Charlemagne, Charlemagne. That was why my anger was roused. And to be faithful to my calling as a knight-errant, I sought to give aid and protection to those who fled, and with this good intention I did what you have seen.
If the result has been the opposite of what I intended, it is no fault of mine but of those wicked beings that persecute me. But for all that I am willing to condemn myself in costs for this error of mine, though it did not proceed from malice. Let Master Pedro see what he wants for the spoiled figures, for I agree to pay it at once in good and current money of Castile.
Master Pedro made him a bow, saying, I expected no less of the rare Christianity of the valiant Don Quixote of La Mancha, true helper and protector of all destitute and needy vagabonds. Master Landlord here and the great Sancho Panza shall be the arbitrators and appraisers between your worship and me of what these dilapidated figures are worth, or may be worth. The landlord and Sancho consented, and then Master Pedro picked up from the ground King Marsilio of Saragossa with his head off, and said, Here you see how impossible it is to restore this king to his former state, so I think, saving your better judgments, that for his death, decease, and demise, 4 reals and a half may be given me.
Proceed, said Don Quixote.
Well, then, for this cleavage from top to bottom, continued Master Pedro, taking up the split Emperor Charlemagne, it would not be much if I were to ask 5 reals and a quarter.
It's not little, said Sancho.
Nor is it much, said the landlord. Make it even and say 5 reals.
Let him have the whole 5 and a quarter, said Don Quixote, for the sum total of this notable disaster does not stand on a quarter more or less. And make an end of it quickly, Master Pedro, for it's getting on to supper-time, and I have some hints of hunger.
For this figure, said Master Pedro, that is without a nose and wants an eye, and is the fair Melisendra, I ask, and I am reasonable in my charge, 2 reals and 12 maravedis.
The very devil must be in it, said Don Quixote, if Melisendra and her husband are not by this time at least on the French border, for the horse they rode on seemed to me to fly rather than gallop. So you needn't try to sell me the cat for the hare, showing me here a noseless Melisendra when she is now, maybe, enjoying herself at her ease with her husband in France. God help every one to his own, Master Pedro, and let us all proceed fairly and honestly. Now, go on.
Master Pedro, perceiving that Don Quixote was beginning to wander and return to his original fancy, was not disposed to let him escape, so he said to him,
This cannot be Melisendra, but must be one of the damsels that waited on her. So if I'm given 60 maravedis for her, I'll be content and sufficiently paid.
And so he went on, putting values on ever so many more smashed figures, which, after the two arbitrators had adjusted them to the satisfaction of both parties, came to 40 reals and 3 quarters. And over and above this sum, which Sancho at once dispersed, Master Pedro asked for 2 reals for his trouble in catching the ape.
"Let him have them, Sancho," said Don Quixote, "not to catch the ape, but to get drunk. And 200 would I give this minute for the good news to anyone who could tell me positively that the Lady Doña Melisendra and Señor Don Gaiferos were now in France, and with their own people."
"No one could tell us that better than my ape," said Master Pedro, "but there's no devil that could catch him now. I suspect, however, that affection and hunger will drive him to come looking for me tonight. But tomorrow we'll soon be here, and we shall see."
In short, the puppet show storm passed off, and all supped in peace and good fellowship at Don Quixote's expense, for he was the height of generosity. Before it was daylight, the man with the lances and halberds took his departure, and soon after daybreak the cousin and the page came to bid Don Quixote farewell, the former returning home, the latter resuming his journey, towards which, to help him, Don Quixote gave him 12 reals. Master Pedro did not care to engage in any more palaver with Don Quixote, whom he knew right well. So he rose before the sun, and having got together the remains of his show and caught his ape, he too went off to seek his adventures. The landlord, who did not know Don Quixote, was as much astonished at his mad freaks as at his generosity. To conclude, Sancho, by his master's orders, paid him very liberally, and taking leave of him they quitted the inn at about 8 in the morning. And took to the road, where we will leave them to pursue their journey, for this is necessary in order to allow certain other matters to be set forth, which are required to clear up this famous history. Chapter 27. Wherein it is shown who Master Pedro and his ape were, together with the mishap Don Quixote had in the braying adventure, which he did not conclude as he would have liked, or as he had expected. Cide Hamete, the chronicler of this great history, begins this chapter with these words, I swear as a Catholic Christian, with regard to which his translator says that Cide Hamete swearing as a Catholic Christian, he being, as no doubt he was, a Moor, only meant that just as a Catholic Christian taking an oath swears or ought to swear what is true and tell the truth in what he avers, so he was telling the truth as much as if he swore as a Catholic Christian in all he chose to write about Quixote, especially in declaring who Master Pedro was and what was the divining ape that astonished all in the villages with his divinations. He says, then, that he who has read the first part of this history will remember well enough the Gines de Pasamonte, whom, with other galley slaves, Don Quixote set free in the Sierra Morena, a kindness for which he afterwards got poor thanks and worse payment from that evil-minded, ill-conditioned set. This Gines de Pasamonte, Don Ginesilio de Parapilla, Don Quixote called him, it was that stole Dapple from Sancho Panza, which, because by the fault of the printers, neither the how nor the when was stated in the first part, has been a puzzle to a good many people, who attribute to the bad memory of the author what was the error of the press. In fact, however, Gines stole him while Sancho Panza was asleep on his back, adopting the plan and device that Brunello had recourse to when he stole Sacripante's horse from between his legs at the siege of Albracca. And, as has been told, Sancho afterwards recovered him. This Gines, then, afraid of being caught by the officers of justice who were looking for him to punish him for his numberless rascalities and offences, which were so many and so great that he himself wrote a big book giving an account of them, resolved to shift his quarters into the kingdom of Aragon, and to cover up his left eye and take up the trade of a puppet showman. For this, as well as juggling, he knew how to practice to perfection. From some released Christians returning from Barbary, it so happened he bought the ape, which he taught to mount upon his shoulder on his making a certain sign, and to whisper, or seem to do so, in his ear. Thus prepared, before entering any village whither he was bound with his show and his ape, he used to inform himself at the nearest village, or from the most likely person he could find, as to what particular things had happened there and to whom, and bearing them well in mind, the first thing he did was to exhibit his show, sometimes one story, sometimes another, but all lively, amusing, and familiar. As soon as the exhibition was over, he brought forward the accomplishments of his ape, assuring the public that he divined all the past and the present, but as to the future he had no skill. For each question answered he asked 2 reals, and for some he made a reduction, just as he happened to feel the pulse of the questioners. And when, now and then, he came to houses where things that he knew of had happened to the people living there, even if they did not ask him a question, not caring to pay for it, he would make the sign to the ape and then declare that it had said so-and-so, which fitted the case exactly. In this way he acquired a prodigious name, and all ran after him. On other occasions, being very crafty, he would answer in such a way that the answers suited the questions— and as no one cross-questioned him or pressed him to tell how his ape divined, he made fools of them all and filled his pouch. The instant he entered the inn he knew Don Quixote and Sancho, and with that knowledge it was easy for him to astonish them and all who were there. But it would have cost him dear had Don Quixote brought down his hand a little lower when he cut off King Marsilio's head and destroyed all his horsemen, as related in the preceding chapter. So much for Master Pedro and his ape. And now to return to Don Quixote of La Mancha. After he had left the inn, he determined to visit, first of all, the banks of the Ebro and that neighbourhood, before entering the city of Saragossa, for the ample time there was still to spare before the jousts left him enough for all. With this object in view, he followed the road and travelled along it for 2 days, without meeting any adventure worth committing to writing, until on the 3rd day, as he was ascending a hill, he heard a great noise of drums, trumpets, and musket shots. At first he imagined some regiment of soldiers was passing that way, and to see them he spurred Rocinante and mounted the hill. On reaching the top, he saw at the foot of it over 200 men, as it seemed to him, armed with weapons of various sorts, lances, crossbows, partisans, halberds, and pikes, and a few muskets and a great many shields. He descended the slope and approached the band near enough to see distinctly the flags, make out the colours, and distinguish the devices they bore, especially one on a standard or ensign of white satin, on which there was painted in a very lifelike style an ass like the little Sardinian kind, with its head up, its mouth open, and its tongue out, as if it were in the act and attitude of braying, and round it were inscribed in large characters these 2 lines. They did not bray in vain, our alderman twain. From this device Don Quixote concluded that these people must be from the braying town, and he said so to Sancho, explaining to him what was written on the standard. At the same time he observed that the man who had told them about the matter was wrong in saying that the two who brayed were counsellors, for according to the lines of the standard they were aldermen. To which Sancho replied, "Señor, there's nothing to stick at in that, for maybe the counsellors who brayed then came to be aldermen of their town afterwards, and so they may go by both titles. Moreover, it has nothing to do with the truth of the story whether the brayers were aldermen or counsellors, provided, at any rate, they did bray. For an alderman is just as likely to bray as a counsellor." They perceived, in short, clearly, that the town which had been twitted had turned out to do battle with some other that had jeered it more than was fair or neighbourly. Don Quixote proceeded to join them, not a little to Sancho's uneasiness, for he never relished mixing himself up in expeditions of that sort. The members of the troop received him into the midst of them, taking him to be someone who was on their side. Don Quixote, putting up his visor, advanced with an easy bearing and demeanour to the standard with the ass, and all the chief men of the army gathered round him to look at him, staring at him with the usual amazement that everybody felt on seeing him for the first time. Don Quixote, seeing them examining him so attentively, and that none of them spoke to him or put any question to him, determined to take advantage of their silence. So, breaking his own, he lifted up his voice and said, "Worthy sirs, I entreat you as earnestly as I can not to interrupt an argument I wish to address to you, until you find it displeases or wearies you. And if that come to pass, on the slightest hint you give me, I will put a seal upon my lips and a gag upon my tongue." They all bade him say what he liked, for they would listen to him willingly. With this permission, Don Quixote went on to say, "I am, sirs, a knight-errant whose calling is that of arms, and whose profession is to protect those who require protection, and give help to such as stand in need of it. Some days ago I became acquainted with your misfortune and the cause which impels you to take up arms again and again to revenge yourselves upon your enemies. And having many times thought over your business in my mind, I find that according to the laws of combat you are mistaken in holding yourselves insulted. For a private individual cannot insult an entire community, unless it be by defying it collectively as a traitor, because he cannot tell who in particular is guilty of the treason for which he defies it. Of this we have an example in Don Diego Ordóñez de Lara, who defied the whole town of Zamora because he did not know that Valladolid alone had committed the treachery of slaying his king. And therefore he defied them all, and the vengeance and the reply concerned all. Though, to be sure, Señor Don Diego went rather too far, indeed very much beyond the limits of a defiance, for he had no occasion to defy the dead, or the waters, or the fishes, or those yet unborn, and all the rest of it, as set forth. But let that pass, for when anger breaks out there's no father, governor, or bridle to check the tongue. The case being, then, that no one person can insult a kingdom, province, city, state, or entire community, it is clear there is no reason for going out to avenge the defiance of such an insult, inasmuch as it is not one. A fine thing it would be if the people of the Clock Town were to be at loggerheads every moment with everyone who called them by that name, or those with names that mean milksop, or aubergine, or white calf, or soapmaker, or the bearers of all the other names and titles that are always in the mouth of the boys and common people. It would be a nice business indeed if all these illustrious cities were to take huff and revenge themselves and go about perpetually making trombones of their swords in every petty quarrel. No, no, God forbid. There are four things for which sensible men and well-ordered states ought to take up arms, draw their swords, and risk their persons, lives, and properties. The first is to defend the Catholic faith. The second, to defend one's life, which is in accordance with natural and divine law. The third, in defense of one's honor, family, and property. The fourth, in the service of one's king in a just war. And if to these we choose to add a fifth, which may be included in the second, in defence of one's country. To these five, as it were, capital causes, there may be added some others that may be just and reasonable, and make it a duty to take up arms. But to take them up for trifles and things to laugh at and be amused by rather than offended, looks as though he who did so was altogether wanting in common sense. Moreover, to take an unjust revenge, and there cannot be any just one, is directly opposed to the sacred law that we acknowledge, wherein we are commanded to do good to our enemies and to love them that hate us.
a command which, though it seems somewhat difficult to obey, is only so to those who have in them less of God than of the world, and more of the flesh than of the spirit. For Jesus Christ, God and true man, who never lied and could not and cannot lie, said, as our lawgiver, that his yoke was easy and his burden light. He would not therefore have laid any command upon us that it was impossible to obey. Thus, sirs, you are bound to keep quiet by human and divine law.
The devil take me, said Sancho to himself at this, but this master of mine is a born priest, or if not, faith, he's as like one as one egg is like another.
Don Quixote stopped to take breath, and observing that silence was still preserved, he had a mind to continue his discourse, and would have done so had not Sancho interposed with his smartness, for he, seeing his master pause, took the lead, saying,
"My lord Don Quixote of La Mancha, who once was called Knight of the Rueful Countenance, but now is called the Knight of the Lions, is a gentleman of great discretion, who knows Latin and his mother tongue like a bachelor, and in everything he deals with or advises, proceeds like a good soldier, and has all the laws and ordinances of what they call combat at his fingers' ends. So you have nothing to do but to let yourselves be guided by what he says, and on my head be it if it is wrong. Besides which, you have been told that it is folly to take offence at merely hearing a bray. Well, I remember when I was a boy I brayed as often as I had a fancy, without anyone hindering me, and so elegantly and naturally, that when I brayed, all the asses in the town would bray. But I was none the less for that the son of my parents, who were greatly respected. And though I was envied because of the gift by more than one of the high and mighty ones of the town, I did not care two farthings for it. And that you may see I am telling the truth, wait a bit and listen, for this art, like swimming, once learnt, is never forgotten." And then, taking hold of his nose, he began to bray so vigorously that all the valleys around rang again. One of those, however, that stood near him, fancying he was mocking them, lifted up a long staff he had in his hand, and smote him such a blow with it that Sancho dropped helpless to the ground. Don Quixote, seeing him so roughly handled, attacked the man who had struck him lance in hand, but so many thrust themselves between them that he could not avenge him. Far from it, finding a shower of stones rained upon him, and crossbows and muskets unnumbered levelled at him, he wheeled Rocinante round and, as fast as his best gallop could take him, fled from the midst of them, commending himself to God with all his heart to deliver him out of this peril, in dread every step of some ball coming in at his back and coming out at his breast, and every minute drawing his breath to see whether it had gone from him. The members of the band, however, were satisfied with seeing him take to flight, and did not fire on him. They put up Sancho, scarcely restored to his senses, on his ass, and let him go after his master. Not that he was sufficiently in his wits to guide the beast, but Dapple followed the footsteps of Rocinante, from whom he could not remain a moment separated. Don Quixote, having got some way off, looked back, and seeing Sancho coming, waited for him, as he perceived that no one followed him. The men of the troop stood their ground till night, and as the enemy did not come out to battle, they returned to their town exulting. And had they been aware of the ancient custom of the Greeks, they would have erected a trophy on the spot. Chapter 28. Of matters that Benengeli says he who reads them will know, if he reads them with attention. When the brave man flees, treachery is manifest, and it is for wise men to reserve themselves for better occasions. This proved to be the case with Don Quixote, who, giving way before the fury of the townsfolk and the hostile intentions of the angry troop, took to flight and, without a thought of Sancho or the danger in which he was leaving him, retreated to such a distance as he thought made him safe. Sancho, lying across his ass, followed him, as has been said, and at length came up, having by this time recovered his senses, and on joining him let himself drop off Dapple at Rocinante's feet, sore, bruised, and belaboured. Don Quixote dismounted to examine his wounds, but finding him whole from head to foot, he said to him, angrily enough,
"In an evil hour didst thou take to braying, Sancho. Where hast thou learned that it is well done to mention the rope in the house of the man that has been hanged? To the music of brays what harmonies couldst thou expect to get but cudgels? Give thanks to God, Sancho, that they signed the cross on thee just now with a stick and did not mark thee per signum crucis with a cutlass."
"I'm not equal to answering," said Sancho, "for I feel as if I was speaking through my shoulders. Let us mount and get away from this. I'll keep from braying, but not from saying that knight-errants fly and leave their good squires to be pounded like privet or made meal of at the hands of their enemies.
He does not fly who retires, returned Don Quixote. For I would have thee know, Sancho, that the valour which is not based upon a foundation of prudence is called rashness, and the exploits of the rash man are to be attributed rather to good fortune than to courage. And so I own that I retired, but not that I fled. Therein I have followed the example of many valiant men who have reserved themselves for better times. The histories are full of instances of this, but as it would not be any good to thee or pleasure to me, I will not recount them to thee now. Sancho was by this time mounted with the help of Don Quixote, who then himself mounted Rocinante, and at a leisurely pace they proceeded to take shelter in a grove which was in sight about a quarter of a league off. Every now and then Sancho gave vent to deep sighs and dismal groans, and on Don Quixote asking him what caused such acute suffering, he replied that, from the end of his backbone up to the nape of his neck, he was so sore that it nearly drove him out of his senses.
"The cause of that soreness," said Don Quixote, "will be, no doubt, that the staff wherewith they smote thee, being a very long one, it caught thee all down the back, where all the parts that are sore are situated. And had it reached any further, thou wouldst be sorer still."
"By God," said Sancho, "your worship has relieved me of a great doubt, and cleared up the point for me in elegant style. Body o' me! Is the cause of my soreness such a mystery that there's any need to tell me I am sore everywhere the staff hit me? If it was my ankles that pained me, there might be something in going divining why they did. But it's not much to divine that I'm sore where they thrashed me. By my faith, master mine, the ills of others hang by a hair. Every day I am discovering more and more how little I have to hope for from keeping company with your worship. For if this time you have allowed me to be drubbed, the next time, or 100 times more, will have the blanketings of the other day over again, and all the other pranks which, if they have fallen on my shoulders now, will be thrown in my teeth by and by. I would do a great deal better if I was not an ignorant brute that will never do any good all my life. I would do a great deal better, I say, to go home to my wife and children and support them and bring them up on what God may please to give me, instead of following your worship along roads that lead nowhere and paths that are none at all, with little to drink and less to eat. And then when it comes to sleeping, measure out 7 feet on the earth, brother squire, and if that's not enough for you, take as many more, for you may have it all your own way and stretch yourself to your heart's content. Oh, that I could see, burnt and turned to ashes, the first man that meddled with knight-errantry, or at any rate, the first who chose to be squire to such fools as all knights-errant of past times must have been. Of those of the present day I say nothing, because as your worship is one of them, I respect them, and because I know your worship knows a point more than the devil in all you say and think.
I would lay a good wager with you, Sancho, said Don Quixote, that now that you are talking on without anyone to stop you, you don't feel a pain in your whole body. Talk away, my son, say whatever comes into your head or mouth, for so long as you feel no pain, the irritation your impertinences give me will be a pleasure to me. And if you are so anxious to go home to your wife and children, God forbid that I should prevent you. You have money of mine. See how long it is since we left our village this third time, and how much you can and ought to earn every month, and pay yourself out of your own hand.
When I worked for Tom Carrasco, the father of the bachelor Samson Carrasco that your worship knows, replied Sancho, I used to earn 2 ducats a month besides my food. I can't tell what I can earn with your worship, though I know a knight-errant squire has harder times of it than he who works for a farmer. For after all, we who work for farmers, however much we toil all day, at the worst, at night, we have a stew for our supper and sleep in a bed, which I have not slept in since I have been in your worship's service, if it wasn't the short time we were in Don Diego de Miranda's house, and the feast I had with the skimmings I took off Camacho's pots, and what I ate, drank, and slept in Basilio's house. All the rest of the time, I have been sleeping on the hard ground under the open sky, exposed to what they call the inclemencies of heaven, keeping life in me with scraps of cheese and crusts of bread, and drinking water either from the brooks or from the springs we come to on these bypaths we travel.
I own, Sancho, said Don Quixote, that all thou sayest is true. How much thinkest thou ought I to give thee over and above what Tom Carrasco gave thee?
I think, said Sancho, that if your worship was to add on 2 reals a month, I'd consider myself well paid, that is, as far as the wages of my labour go. But to make up to me for your worship's pledge and promise to me to give me the government of an island, it would be fair to add 6 reals more, making 30 in all.
Very good, said Don Quixote. It is 25 days since we left our village, so reckon up, Sancho, according to the wages you have made out for yourself, and see how much I owe you in proportion, and pay yourself, as I said before, out of your own hand. "Oh, body o' me," said Sancho, "but your worship is very much out in that reckoning, for when it comes to the promise of the island we must count from the day your worship promised it to me to this present hour we are at now."
"Well, how long is it, Sancho, since I promised it to you?" said Don Quixote.
"If I remember rightly," said Sancho, "it must be over 20 years, 3 days more or less."
Don Quixote gave himself a great slap on the forehead and began to laugh heartily, and said he, "Why, I have not been wandering either in the Sierra Morena or in the whole course of our